Hello, I'm Rich Kilgariff. Welcome to Bookomi. The OMI in Bookomi stands for Original Memorable Insights, helping us to get smarter, faster, together with the most wanted minds in business, science, technology, and culture. In this episode,
I'm David Eagleman. I'm a neuroscientist, an entrepreneur, a TV presenter, and a teacher, and I'm author of many books, including my latest, Live Wired, and this is my OMI for Bookomi.
We meet the world-famous, multi-talented neuroscientist shining a light into the dark, mysterious, magnificent cavity behind your eyes.
You can't really think about the brain like hardware, and you can't think about it like software. And what's really required is a completely new concept, which is what I call liveware. And the idea is, this is a system that is constantly rewiring itself every moment of your life.
Professor David Eagleman has dedicated his life to understanding the brain, people, and society. As well as teaching neuroscience at Stanford University, he's written hundreds of academic articles and textbooks, plus award-winning, best-selling fiction and non-fiction that has inspired students, readers, and artists around the world. His book, Some Tales from the Afterlives, was made into an opera by Brian Eno, and his book, The Brain, The Story of You, was made into an Emmy-nominated TV series, which he presented, specializing in brain plasticity, sensory substitution, time perception, synesthesia, and neurolaw. He also sits on the boards of several science foundations and nonprofits, and is the CEO of Neosensory, a company which translates the unheard and the unseen into real feelings. His new book, Live Wired, The Inside Story of the Ever-Changing Brain, takes us on a fantastic voyage under the cortex and into the neural networks that shape who we are from the day we're born to the end of life. David, it could probably take me a lifetime introducing you with your accumulated accolades. Welcome.
My mother would be so proud, Rich. Thank you.
You know what? And that's really is literally the tip of the iceberg as well. I had to cut that down. That's a good cozy 20 minutes into the podcast and we finished introducing. Anyway, you are amazingly well qualified and everything just adds testament to the sheer weight of the knowledge and expertise that went into the writing of Live Wired. And it's all about the constant shape-shifting and adaptation of the human brain throughout life. And you point out that just by reading the book, or any book actually, we've changed who we are forever. How did you personally change in the writing of it? Were there any insights gathered that you didn't have at the beginning? And do you feel strange looking back at the books you wrote at the beginning of your writing career? Have you changed a lot since then?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's an interesting question because there's a sense in which a book is an illusion that when somebody picks up a book, they think, wow, the author knew all of this stuff from the first page to the last. But in fact, of course, you're learning a lot in the writing of it. And you're reshaping it and you're changing things and you're cutting paragraphs and adding new insights. So the question is, during the course of the book, essentially my goal was to take the nowadays tens of thousands of academic papers about plasticity, which is the ability of the brain to reshape itself, reconfigure itself, which it's doing every second of your life. And I wanted to come up with some principles. What is going on here? What is the overarching theory about what's happening and why? And so that's what I was able to do over the course of writing this book. I'm embarrassed to admit, actually, this book took me 10 years. I worked on this. And along the way, I got it down. I distilled it to seven principles and I came up with many new things. For example, a new hypothesis about why we dream at night, which I think is correct. And it's the first of its kind. So anyway, yes, I'm much smarter at the end of this book than the beginning. And I guess I would say that for all my books.
I did notice that actually in reading the book, apart from the seven principles, which we'll just talk about in a bit, you know, yeah, there's some new, you've rolled in some new theories there based on what you know and fulfilling the model that you explain in the book of, as an adult, we add different bits of experience to an existing, like you describe, like a Pontilist painting, like an impressionist painting of our mind. And I noticed the new brush strokes in there on the brain and dream. We'll get into that in a minute. We're all born though. So going back to the beginning, we're all born with the same broadly the same neural human framework, which then gets wired with different experiences. So if so, how do we know along the way which experiences and senses are worth paying attention to?
So this is the great trick of Mother Nature when it comes to humans is drop the brain into the world half-baked and let the world wire up the rest of it. And so, you know, as opposed to, let's say, a crocodile, which drops in the world essentially totally, you know, ready to go to eat and run and swim and stuff like that, we take many years to get functional as humans. The kinds of things we pay attention to, that actually changes over the lifetime. So when you're a baby, you're essentially absorbing everything. As you get older, it becomes more about relevance to your goals. And so your brain doesn't really take in things that it doesn't need to know. For example, if I were to tell you 10 interesting facts from Mongolian history, you probably wouldn't really retain that. But if I told you something that was really important to you, I told you something that was happening on your street or to some relative in your family or whatever, then it really matters. It'll stick, you'll remember it. And everything has to do with what is relevant to us in terms of, you know, from the long term of survival to the short term of who you are as a person. And what happens is, because we all absorb these different experiences, we all go off very different trajectories. First of all, we all come to the table with slightly different genetics, and that combined with your experiences sends you off on these different pathways. And that's why, in fact, people are actually quite different on the inside. Even the people we know and we love and are very close to, you know, we all know that, you know, just from having misunderstandings and conversations with people we know, that people can be quite different on the inside.
You quote the philosophers at Heidegger at the beginning, saying that we evolve into being one person. We start off as many people, and then we evolve into one.
No, I was just going to say, it's one of my favorite quotations because, right, the quotation is, we start off, each man is born as many men and dies as one. And the idea is that you drop into the world with a lot of potential to be many different things. But of course, the day you die, you've become who you are.
And that's really, it actually really made me think of Walt Whitman and, you know, and his quotes, and he is large. Does he contradict himself? He's large. He contains multitudes, and the whole notion of multitudes and the whole notion of being different people. And that quote that you just shared there, and is at the beginning of the book and runs through the book as an idea, is really interesting because I was in two minds about it, funnily enough, because I was like, well, do I feel comfortable with that? Are we less of a person as we go through life? Do we diminish ourselves? Do we start off amazing and then become less amazing and more ordinary? Or is it the other way around?
No, you know, this is one of those funny things about life. When you open a door to go through it, it just means that you're foregoing other doors. So, you know, I can become a neuroscientist, but I'll never become an architect as a result. That stinks. I would, you know, I love to know about that. But, you know, every choice you make is your pathways. And that's just the truth of it. We have a limited amount of time. And so that's the sense when I was born, I could have been an architect or a neuroscientist or any of 1,000 other professions. But here I am going down one pathway. The way it goes. This is actually one of the themes of the book, of course, is that to gain expertise in anything means that you're burning programs into your circuitry in such a way that you limit the other things that you can do. And this is just one of the necessary things that we have to do as we go through life, is get good at something.
You're absolutely right. We only have one brain. We only have one life, and we have one career. I mean, you are a polymath. You do many different things. You might specialize in neuroscience, but you know, people might describe you as an artist as well, and a performer. You're a philanthropist, you're an entrepreneur, all these different things. But just as in life, the brain, just as in life, is competing, or different regions of the brain are competing with each other, aren't they? For resources, for energy, just as our attention is in life. When we sleep, you mentioned dreaming earlier, when we sleep, do all the competing forces shut down and call a truce?
Right. So this is my new hypothesis about what's going on when we sleep. So one of the things that we've learned in neuroscience is that everything in the brain is competing with everything else. So for example, you have vision and hearing and touch, and these are generally occupying different regions of your brain. But what happens if you go blind suddenly is that the hearing and the touch will take over that territory. It's always a competition for land. And what I realized with a student of mine is that when the planet rotates into darkness at night, the visual system is at a disadvantage that the other senses are not. So you can still hear at night and touch at night, but you can't see at night. And of course, I'm talking about evolutionary timescales, electricity. So what I realized is that every night the visual is in danger of getting taken over by the other senses, because we now know this happens very quickly. Within about an hour, you can start seeing the other senses making their move, their encroachment into this territory. And so what I hypothesize is that dreaming is actually the system's way of saying, look, I'm on a rotating planet and I'm going into darkness for half the hours. And it's a way of shooting activity into the visual system. So when you look at the anatomy of it, it's very specific. It starts in a particular part in the brain stem and goes to this other place and then this other place, and it blasts activity into the visual system. And we experience that as seeing. We think, oh, I'm having a visual experience. But really the reason for dreaming is to keep the visual cortex defended at nighttime against the other senses. So I've now, at this point, compiled a lot of information, just written an 18-page paper on this, and I actually think this is right. There's a ton of information that all supports this, and we've compared across animal species, and the general story is the more plastic or malleable the brain of that species, the more REM sleep it has, the more dream sleep it has at night.
I see. And are we actually, it's quite hard to find the words, but how are we actually imagining that we're seeing while we're dreaming? Obviously, our eyes aren't open. So,
It turns out vision has nothing, it has very little to do with the eyes. So your visual cortex, which is at the back of your head, when that's active, you see. And it turns out that your eyes are only contributing about 5% of the input to your visual cortex. The rest is coming from other areas of the brain and memory and your internal model of what you expect to be out there. And so it turns out that, dreaming is all the evidence you need of this, which is to say, your eyes are closed at night and you're having full, rich visual experience. You just don't need the eyes for it. It's an internal experience.
And is that to do with the fact that we're making up most of the picture as we go along, as the input comes into our eyes,
exactly.
Into our retina.
It totally depends on your experience with the world and your internal model. So when I'm in my house, I know, okay, the door's there, the couch is there, and so on, and I'm not actually seeing a lot of what's going on because it all fulfills my expectations. You only pay attention when something violates your expectations, when something is suddenly not right. So if I snuck into your house and moved your couch over by 6 inches and you walk in the room, you might notice that. You think, whoa, that's weird, because there's a violation, but otherwise you won't even see it as such.
It's really interesting that. And the time when our mind is the most open to new things and new experiences, obviously when we're born or when we're a child and when we're developing. And then
that's right. Or when you go somewhere new. So if you travel to a foreign land, you're like a child again, in the sense that you're paying attention, you're drinking in the sights, you're having to pay attention to what's the name of that store, what's the name of the street, where am I? And because you're being forced to pay attention is like being an infant again.
And is that why, sorry to mention the L word, lockdown, but is that why... as our experience of the world is, we're seeing the same things every day almost, meetings with people on Zoom are literally the same shape in the same place with less new external experiences. What effect will that be having on our memory? And why does time seem to go faster when you do the same thing every day?
Yeah, it's because the way that your brain judges how much time has passed is by drawing on landmarks, by looking at your footage in your memory and saying, okay, well, there was so many experiences. It must have been a long time since this thing happened. But what's happening in lockdown is that, we're trapped in the same four walls. And even though we're facing new kinds of challenges about our children or how to get food in the fridge or whatever, it's essentially, there's not a lot of totally new memory going on. And so what happens is when you look back and you think, wait, what's happened with the last 4 months? It's very hard to draw on specific instances. Oh yeah, here's that, and then that happened, and that happened. And so instead, your brain has a very difficult time determining how much time has passed in lockdown. And that's what we're all facing. The other interesting part to me, by the way, is this is in the forward direction too, which is, especially at the beginning of this, you have a very hard time thinking into the future, thinking distantly into the future when you have anxiety about things that are lower on, let's say, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you know, so when you're thinking about food and shelter, as in, how do I make sure that I have enough food? How do I make sure there's enough toilet paper? This sort of thing. It's very hard to think distantly in the future, as in, what kind of person do I want to be? And, you know, what sort of charities do I want to give to next year? And so on. And so both in the backwards and the forwards direction, time has been very funny during lockdown.
Yeah, funny is one way of describing it. Funny, funny, peculiar. So in terms of the way the brain works and the inputs, we talk about having the same inputs in lockdown, and we're all experiencing that. It's a very interesting collective experience, isn't it? But going back to the 50s, because neuroscience or the advances though that you've grown up with are relatively new, aren't they, in terms of medical history? The neurosurgeon Wilder Penfield, was it, probed the brain of monkeys, and who were ill anyway, actually, might that point out. Was it monkeys who was probing?
It was a human. No, it was human.
It was a human being. Sorry. So that reads into the story of the monkeys, doesn't it? And then he probed the brain, and he came up with the concept of the homunculus, the little man, relating different bits of the brain to different parts of the body. Has science leapt forward from that point, or is that still the framework that you use to explain why different inputs from different senses and limbs affect the brain?
No, that has remained true. I mean, that's just a true thing that he found, which is there's a little strip of your brain about where you would wear headphones over your head called the motor cortex. And just next to that is the cortex, the strip that's taking in data from the body called the somatosensory cortex. But the point is that both of these have a little map of the body on them. And that's just true. That thing part that I point out there is that map, you know, one might guess, maybe it's genetically determined that there's a map of the body there. But there was a discovery in the 80s, which was that this was the monkey experiment that you started referring to, if a monkey, let's say, loses an arm or loses input from that arm, the map of the body changes. In the brain, the way it's represented in the brain, that changes. And this is what happens, we now know, with amputees and so on. So the new discovery is that it is flexible, this map. It is modifiable during a lifetime. And it turns out this just has to do with the way that the brain, of course, is locked in silence and darkness. It has no idea what your body looks like. And so what it's doing is constructing this map of what your body must look like based on the input that's coming in. And this is just one example of many about the plasticity of the brain, how it's dynamically reforming itself based on, for example, the inputs that it receives.
And in terms of who we are as people, are we the sum of our past experience, and do we reach the point in our life when we just become set in our ways, like we've got used to using our hands unless we're unlucky enough to lose one, and then, you know, we kind of compensate? Or, you know, as you say in the book, changes in the brain happen only when there's a difference between what was expected and what actually happens.
Yeah.
When we don't have so many surprises in life, are we just set in our ways? Is that it for the rest of our lives? Does our plasticity diminish as we get older?
The amount of change that you're making tends to diminish as you get older. But this isn't necessarily a function of the brain. It's more a function of the choices that we make. And so one of the most important things as people get older is to constantly seek novelty and challenge oneself. Unfortunately, what happens for just about everybody is that, you know, as things move along and you get good at something you're doing, you tend to stick with that because you get rewarded from society for being good at X, and so you stick with it. And that's actually really problematic from the point of view of brain plasticity, because you make an internal model, you become expert in something, but then you have very little change. The reason we know this is a problem is because when people retire, for example, and grow very elderly, you know, they get things like Alzheimer's, they get cognitive deficits. And there was a study that at least is quite famous within neuroscience, which is the study of nuns, these sisters who lived in convents, and these hundreds or possibly thousands now of nuns agreed to donate their brains upon their death. And so what the investigators found, much to everybody's surprise, is that some number of these nuns had Alzheimer's disease and their brains were getting physically chewed up by this. And yet they did not show any cognitive deficits while they were alive. And it turns out it's because they lived in the convent till the day they died. They had tasks, they had chores and responsibilities, they had social interaction with the other nuns, which, you know, that's one of the most challenging things that the brain does, because you never know what someone else is going to say. They kept cognitively active until the day they died. And what that was doing was building new roadways in their brain. So even as parts of it were degenerating, they were having plasticity and enjoying the building of these new pathways. And so that saved them from these cognitive sorts of deficits. So the point is, it would be great if all of us can just make sure having shrinking lives and sit on the couch and watch television and not challenge ourselves.
And I love in all your books that I've read of yours, David, I love your use of language and the metaphors and the allegories that you use to describe an incredibly complex organ, the most complex organ in the universe. And you often use darkness, the dark cave, a crypt of silence and darkness. You describe the brain as the dark vault of the skull, to describe it, as if in contrast to the electrochemical sparks that come in from the peripheral devices that you call them hands and eyes. And the temptation is, and I know lots of people in the AI field like to do this and compare the brain to a computer or a hard drive processing inputs and data from external sources. You sort of push against that, don't you? You don't like that analogy.
Right, exactly right. In fact, that's why I call this book Livewired, because what I started doing some years ago is trying to make clear that you can't really think about the brain like hardware, and you can't think about it like software. And what's really required is a completely new concept, which is what I call liveware. And the idea is, this is a system that is constantly rewiring itself every moment of your life. And it's just totally unlike the way that we build a trim, efficient piece of hardware, and then we put software on it to do the things that we want. And, you know, engineers pride themselves on cleanliness and efficiency and so on. The brain, Mother Nature, is not really like that. There's lots of redundancy. And of course, you know, by the way, the only things that she has to work with are cells and the chemicals that cells can spit out. And so she puts together 86 billion of these in this incredibly complicated forest. And what you get out of it is, you know, learning and memory and consciousness and personality and everything that we are. And so, yeah, it's just a very different kind of thing. And, you know, when you learn something, so if there's a listener who didn't know me before, and now you know my name is David Eagleman, and you know what my voice sounds like, there are physical changes in the structure of your brain that represent that. So a month from now, if someone says, oh, what was that podcast? And you remember the name, it's because of physical changes in the brain forest. And so that's this incredible kind of machinery that's not at all like what we build or have ever built. And what I do in the last chapters of the book is I make the argument for why we should be drafting off of Mother Nature for this incredible way to build devices, instead of the way that we've built every single devices, our laptops, our cell phones, everything around us doesn't have the kind of flexibility that anything in nature does. So I use the example, for example, of a wolf gets its leg caught in a trap. It chews its leg off and it figures out how to walk on three legs and limps back to where it needs to be. But the Mars rover, Curiosity, you know, its wheel got stuck in the Martian soil and that was the end of it. It died because it was stuck there. And wouldn't it be great if we could build robots that would just, you know, chew off its wheel and then figure out how to operate its body with three wheels instead of four, and just figure out how to do it. So I think what we're looking at is a terrific, entirely new era of building machines in front of us that do biomimicry.
Talking of robots, and I couldn't avoid it because it's one of my favorite shows. You're a scientific advisor on the HBO series Westworld.
That's right.
In which, I bet you're sick of talking about this, aren't you? in which the host androids rise up against their human masters. Now, it raised several questions, and it lost me in about the third series. But it raised several questions about the nature of memory and experience. Lots of moral questions. Do you think popular neuroscience is moving ever closer to popular philosophy, moral philosophy?
Oh, yeah. No, I actually think neuroscience is taking over philosophy. And I say that not to be obnoxious, but just because, so I took lots of philosophy as an undergraduate, and you get into these moral conundrums and you debate them and so on, but there's sort of no answer in the end. But what's happened in many cases in neuroscience is that we can say, okay, look, we can run an experiment on this and actually find the answer to this. So there's a sense in which neuroscience is taking over more and more of philosophy. just as a side note, you know, I don't know if you know this, Rich, but I run this national nonprofit called the Center for Science and Law, which is all about where neuroscience intersects the legal system. And part of it is just coming to understand and bring to light in the legal system that there are many, many things that go on with people's brains that have them intersect with criminal justice. And this doesn't let anybody off the hook. It doesn't give them exculpation. But what it does is it suggests ways to root people forward through the legal system so that we don't have to imagine that incarceration is the one-size-fits-all solution. But instead, we know a lot about the brain now. We know how to help people recover from drug addiction rather than imagining sticking them in jail is going to work. We know how to help people with schizophrenia rather than imagining that putting them in jail is going to work, and so on. So I think there's a lot of issues about philosophy and moral philosophy that as we come to understand better what's happening under the hood, we can address them head on.
And from a neuroscience perspective and from a philosophical perspective, you're very positive about the potential of the internet to constantly unravel new knowledge. And whilst everyone's got to agree Wikipedia is much faster than and deeper than looking stuff up in a library catalogue, I had to do the same thing when I was studying with the pasted little bits of paper in huge leather-bound catalogues. But if digital natives, which our children are, grow up just getting what they want when they want it on a click or a swipe-to-know basis, won't we as a species forget how to be curious beyond our own dark caves and echo chambers?
Oh, gosh. No, I'm very optimistic about this point because one of the points that I make in the book is that change only happens when it's relevant to you. And one level of that is curiosity. For example, if you're curious about something and you get the answer in the context of your curiosity, then it sticks. So for example, let's say that you, for some reason, really started thinking about Mongolian history and you really cared about it suddenly. And you asked me some question and I told you and you said, oh, I get that. I get how that's all connected now with the history of Russia and so on, then it would stick as opposed to if I just told you and you didn't care. So we growing up, you and I, Rich, you know, we had lots of just in case information given to us in schools for years, just in case you ever need to know this or that. But what the opportunity is now is kids getting just in time information where as soon as they want to know, wait, how do I fix this bicycle tire? What's the proper way to paint this or bake this or build this, they look it up, they get the answer right then, and it sticks because they care. And so it's actually a terrific thing, not to mention just having the entire world's knowledge in a rectangle in your pocket where it's, you know, you can just get to know anything. I'm a real cyber optimist on this point from, you know, again, from the point of view of neuroplasticity. This couldn't be better.
I'm on really shaky ground arguing with a neuroscientist about the effect on the brain of the internet. So I should move on. But I just think the as a, you know, somebody who does the same thing, who delves in and out and digs deep into subjects, I worry about information retrieval in digital natives. Is it too disposable? Is it too quick? You know, because the stuff that we thought we might need, the knowledge we might need when we were growing up and studying, at least was there in our banks. And you cover this in the book in detail about memory. My worry and my concern is that we only have bits of information right at the front of our brain, you know, and then it goes and then we forget about it altogether.
Oh gosh. You know, what's interesting is back, let's say 1500 years ago, people would memorize these epic poems and, you know,
I'm not like that old, David.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. So, you know, the Odyssey, the Iliad, things like and poems of all sorts. What happened with the advent of the printing press in the 1400s was that people said exactly the sort of thing. They said, oh my gosh, people aren't going to have memory anymore. Kids, when they want to know something, they just pick up a book on the shelf and all the information's right there. And we're going to get stupider as a society. And it turns out we know that's not actually what happened. When you give people lots of books, they retain much more information and they know where to get it. And it's actually not that useful to fill your brain with memorized facts if you can actually get much more territory covered if you know where to get the facts, as well as having the baseline knowledge that you need. But all the time I end up, presumably like you and everybody, I end up going down these mole holes on Wikipedia, and it's absolutely wonderful because I think, oh wait, what's that? And I click that link, and then I go, and you know, 7 clicks later, I'm on, you know, something that I didn't even know I didn't know. And it's so wonderful to get that kind of knowledge and have all that available to us. And by the way, that sticks quite well. I think the analogy here, by the way, is, you know, the way we used to memorize the phone numbers of our friends. Now we don't need to. Well, thank goodness. That's a lot of information that just took up room that didn't need to.
It's a good way of finding out who your oldest friend is as well, because it's the only number you can remember because you had to. Yeah, I suppose the point is, I suppose, is about diversity. And I think you've sort of answered that question, because as long as you're curious, you can delve into a wide range of things because of the access to knowledge. And I suppose the only downside to specializing or expertise is that you might cut yourself. If, you know, if you go down a rabbit hole, or if you're into dolphins or Mongolia or whatever it is, then you might not, you know, you might not learn anything else.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the other advantage of the internet, is that it is impossible to not be exposed to anything else. If I'm interested in Mongolian dolphins, then I can't not end up on a website that mentions something else, and then, you know, the history of Russia, and then finally I find myself on, you know, what happened to Anastasia and so on.
I love the range that you cover in your books in terms of the way you draw similarities between the makeup of the brain and the external world, business models, city roadmaps, governments, the internet. And in your book, Before Livewired, literally just a month ago, the Safety Net, Surviving Pandemics and Other Disasters, you offer a way to navigate the future post-COVID. What would you say is the single, just I'll end on a light question, if I may, the single biggest threat to civilization right now and the single biggest potential savior?
Well, I think there are... So what I argued in The Safety Net, of course, is that the single biggest savior might actually be the, you know, essentially accidental invention of the internet, because what it gives us is this instantaneous planet-wide communication system. And when you look at the reason that civilizations before us have collapsed, and there have been many, many that have collapsed before us, you can, you know, historians get this down to essentially 6 main categories for why they collapsed. One of them is pandemics, but other things have to do with, you know, even just the speed of information flow or censorship or things that ended up, or, you know, or using all the energy, things that ended up destabilizing the civilization and led to its collapse. And the internet accidentally essentially addresses all of these issues. And what that means is that the threats that we face are going to be different now. I mean, it doesn't mean we don't have threats to civilization now, but they are different. One of the big threats, of course, is just if the internet ever collapses. And you know, you might think, how could that possibly happen? But one of the ways is space weather. So when the sun has these massive coronal mass ejections, as they're called, that can really mess with our electronics. And we have not had that in our modern era. The last one was in the 1890s, but that set all the telegram lines fritzing, and that wasn't even that big of one. So the electromagnetic pulse that we can get from the sun could be a real problem. There was a small one that happened in the 1980s, and it set a bunch of the satellites on the fritz, and everybody's pagers stopped working for a day. And so anyway, this, I think things like this are important to make sure that we have the knowledge stored on, you know, hard media, that we can recreate the internet when we need to. So I proposed in Safety Net having something like a you know, an instruction manual for how to rebuild entirely the internet.
I look forward to reading that one. But you're on the board of the Long Now Foundation as well, aren't you? Which is an incredible organization. I think, do you know Roman Krznaric?
Oh, I just read his essay about being a good ancestor.
A good ancestor. Yeah. Well, we had him on the pod a couple of weeks ago, and right. We were talking about the 10,000-year clock, which just blows my mind.
Yeah.
Have you seen it? Have you seen it? Because it's not finished yet, is it?
It's not finished yet. It's been going on for years and years. I haven't been to the site yet, but of course I see all the pictures of the construction as it's been going for years now.
Incredible.
Yeah.
And so what will our brains look like? And the way we're evolving at the moment, 10,000 years time, who will turn up to that clock? Will it be like the last scene in Planet of the Apes with Charlton Heston shaking his fist at the Statue of Liberty? Or what will it, I just even imagining what that will be like is incredible.
Yeah, exactly. We're too limited. I mean, it's there's no way to know. It would be like cavemen 10,000 years ago trying to picture, you know, the iPhone and Zoom meet. You know, you and I are on different parts of the planet. Two humans on, you know, different parts of the planet. We're just having this instantaneous communication with each other. This is the kind of thing that would have been beyond what they could have imagined. And unfortunately, we're in the same boat here. So the best we can do is just be good ancestors and make sure we're setting things up well for the next generations.
Well, David, it's always amazing and enlightening to spend time inside your head, which you do when you read your books, and it's even more enjoyable speaking to you. Thanks for sharing your Omi with Bukomi today.
Right. Thank you, Rich.
David Eagleman's book, Live Wired, The Inside Story of the Ever-Changing Brain, is available to buy now. Just follow the link in the description of the podcast. If you'd like to be the first to hear and meet the brightest minds behind the smartest new nonfiction, sign up to our most wanted email at bukomi.com. Meanwhile, if you enjoyed this Bukomi pod, please let us know by following or subscribing wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Rich Kilgariff. Stay safe and look after that brain. If you don't use it, you lose it. Bye for now.